All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. It's been a while, but we are here at thatparkplace.com, the website for all things that should be fun, all the news that should be fun. We've got it right here at That Park Place. We are back today with Lauren Connor. Lauren is coming to us, and we're going to be having a chat this, well, it could be the morning, it could be the evening, it could be the day, wherever you are. But we're going to be having a chat with you, because you're a part of this conversation, all about LucasArts. LucasArts is the video game side of Lucasfilm, or at least it once was, and it was very successful and popular during the 80s and 90s, putting out all kinds of games that sort of revolutionized some of the genres that they appeared in. They were not simply limited to Star Wars games, as some people might think is the case today. And so, Lauren, it's great to have you back with us, and how you been?
Very good. Thanks for having me back.
Now, Lauren, you've been doing a number of articles reviewing some of these LucasArts games, sort of doing a retrospect series, and a lot of people have really identified with that. In fact, we've seen some comments from people who haven't thought about these games in decades. And as they read the content that you're putting out, they sort of go back in time with you and reminisce. Can you talk to us about some of these Star Wars games and what they meant to you? Of course, that's not what we're going to be limited to today, but let's start off with Star Wars. How did you come across them, and then where do they sort of sit in your nostalgia?
Well, it's kind of a complicated question, because I didn't come to LucasArts games originally for Star Wars. The very first LucasArts game that I ever played was The Secret of Monkey Island. I came to the Star Wars games through X-Wing purely by accident, in that I was on a family trip to visit one of my dad's former classmates from school for a kind of a summer vacation trip. And while we were there, we went to a mall, and I was going through the shops and came across a software store. And there was a game there that I was very interested in getting. It was called Lands of Lore. It was an RPG made by Westwood Studios. And I had money burning a hole in my pocket, and I had enough to purchase that game, and not quite enough to buy another one at full price, but they had a bargain bin. And in the bargain bin was a copy of X-Wing. I saw it. It was $16. I wasn't particularly interested in it, but I figured that I could pick it up and trade it to somebody else for something that I wanted. And as it happened, after I got it home, I was bored and decided that I would install it anyway. I didn't have a joystick. I didn't have any real fancy peripherals or anything. I was trying to play with a mouse and keyboard, which did not go well at all. But that made me mad because I wasn't any good at the game. And I was a bit of a perfectionist and decided that I wasn't going to let this stupid game beat me. So I started looking around for hints and tips and tricks for playing the game. And before I knew it, I'd gotten hooked. And between that and the Zahn novel series, those were the two things that pretty much pulled me bodily into Star Wars. It's been that way ever since.
So, Lauren, help us understand the timeline here just a little bit. A lot of people who are listening to this, what are we going to call it, this podcast, this dialogue, this conversation, whatever the case may be, a lot of people who are listening in don't necessarily have a place in time or something to hook onto to understand what gaming was like back then. When you're talking about these games, are you talking about something that you went and bought on a CD? Are you talking about something that was on floppy disks? What was it like back then going into a game store or any store that sold video games?
Well, I guess if you're talking about when I was first starting into it for like The Secret of Monkey Island, I'm going to be referencing hardware that younger people probably, they won't even understand what I'm talking about. My computer at the time was called an Amstrad PC, and it had an 8086 processor. It had no hard drive. It had 2 5-and-a-quarter floppy drives and a CGA monitor that displayed 4 colors, most of them garish hues of blue and purple and sort of a very light blue and black. There was no sound card, so all you got was beeps and boops out of the internal speaker. And you had to swap discs many, many times before the game actually began to play. So that was my experience with The Secret of Monkey Island. By the time we got to X-Wing, My parents had upgraded the computer. It was a Packard Bell 38616. I think it had 4 megabytes of RAM. Still no CD-ROM drives, but at least now we had a 40 megabyte hard drive and a VGA monitor, which to me was just amazing. We still didn't have a sound card at that point, but as far as I was concerned, it was the most advanced gaming that I'd ever seen at the time. By today's standards, it's pretty primitive, but you didn't really have a lot of frills back in those days.
So how long was it until you had I believe they were called Sound Blasters. Is that right?
That was one of the major brands. The other major competitor was Adlib. And if you had a lot of money burning a hole in your pocket, you could get a Roland MT32 processor, which was like the cream of the crop.
Right. And so so let's start with Monkey Island then. Tell us a little bit about that sort of nascent first experience with LucasArts.
It's kind of an interesting thing to think about because that game was picked up not that long after we got our first computer. And up until that point, I was a typical kid who was addicted to my Nintendo. I'd never really played any games on a computer before, so having a computer was opening up a whole lot of new doorways. We had bought our computer at a Sears store, and back then they had a software section, and one of these games was The Secret of Monkey Island. My dad found it and was showing it to me, and he thought that the graphics on the back of the box looked really cool. They were, at that time, in EGA quality, but we had a CGA monitor, so it wasn't really representative of what we'd see on our computer. I actually wasn't all that interested in it, but it looked better than anything else that was there. So we picked it up, took it home, got it installed, and the first thing that really caught my attention in the game was the music. Now, this was still on an internal speaker, so it was mono sounding beeps and boops. But what they got out of it,
single channel stuff.
Yeah, and what they got out of it was this really catchy reggae tune that just really just hooked you. And I remember after the conversation with the lookout at the top of the island, and then heading down into the Melee Island town, you'd enter the scum bar, and you'd have conversations with a number of pirates that were in there. It was funny. I was enjoying it. But, and this is kind of a weird way to look at it, but you got to remember, I was coming from playing games on the Nintendo, primarily action-based. When you exited the scum bar, it transited to a cutscene that was following the primary antagonist in the game, the ghost pirate LeChuck. And that was kind of a revelation for me. I had played other games that were also adventure games, mostly Sierra games, but LucasArts was doing it different. And that was something that they touted at the time, was that Sierra games were known for being diabolical in their puzzles. If you missed little details, if you got puzzles wrong, they would kill you mercilessly. And so saving and restoring games was a major factor in playing all of the Sierra titles. LucasArts wasn't punishing. It was they could be frustrating, but they didn't punish the player for playing the game. They always tried to make it fun, and that set them apart from other publishers in my mind.
Yeah, I'm thinking back at some of those Sierra games right now, and as I recall, those were very interesting in that from the time that you started the game, from the time you booted it up, there would be things that were not apparent, were not obvious, and if you didn't figure it out, that was it. There was no exploring the rest of the game. It was just that if you're either going to figure it out, and it may take you 2 hours, and it may be completely obtuse and unobvious, it doesn't matter. If you want to enjoy the game, you're going to have to figure it out.
Yeah, and actually, that dying was part of the gameplay experience in Sierra games, because usually they would give you little hints in the death screen about potentially what you'd be missing. And so it kind of became part of the fun of the games, too, was finding out all the different ways that you could die. But at the same time, it also made the game feel sometimes like it was laughing at you instead of with you. And LucasArts was a little gentler than that.
I'm trying to remember what the name was of the Sierra game. It was part of a series, I believe. But was it called Space Quest, maybe?
Yes.
Whatever it was, I just remember that you started off in this dystopian world where an urban center had been destroyed. And you move the little character around exploring. And if you came close to this one guy who was like a vagabond, whose his eyes were pulled open permanently with a device, he couldn't close his eyes. But if you came near him, it would go to a cutscene where he would scream at you. And then it was game over. And so I had been remembering that. And I and a friend tried our very best to remember what that was. What game was that? So we could go back and see it. And when we finally figured it out and found it, it was so ridiculous looking.
Space Quest 4, Roger Wilco and the Time Rivers.
Isn't that funny that we can remember those kinds of things?
The very first one that I played in that series was actually Space Quest 3. And that was probably the first real computer game that I played. This was before Secret of Monkey Island. And what fascinated me about that game, they changed this in Space Quest 4, but in Space Quest 3, you were still dealing with a text parser. And what I really liked about that game, this was, it's the entire reason why I stopped playing Nintendo, was that you would type something into the text parser, like look at room, and it would give you a description, and there was all kinds of funny stuff. And if you did something foolish or gave an opportunity for the game to make a joke at your expense, it took it. The game itself was insulting you. And some people wouldn't like that, but to me, it felt like, how does it know what I'm saying and do it? It was intelligent enough that it opened up a whole new paradigm for me when it came to gameplay. Nintendo didn't cover that after that.
Sure, and there was the sarcastic humor as well that, you know, it was lightly mocking you at every turn.
Yeah, it was like nothing else. And I think that I'm really sad that Sierra didn't really survive. You know, they kind of hit a rough patch and they didn't survive into the modern day. I liked their titles as well. But everything from that period, I would say from 1990 to around 1999, was like a golden age in some of those old adventure game classics.
Sure. Now, let me cheat for just a minute, Lorne. If we have any listeners out there, any of you who frequent that park place, if you can help me remember what this game is, please drop this down in the comments and tell me so I can look it up. But I was talking with a friend the other day at the very beginning of the move to 3D, where we were doing the polygons. There was some game out there, and it was set in like a fantasy castle kind of background. But this game, the developers, and again, remember, we were at the very, very beginning of polygons. They decided that instead of doing polygons, they were going to build the entire world out of orbs. And so they used different colored orbs, no textures, but they used all different colored orbs to build the world, thinking that that might be the way forward other than polygons. So if anybody knows the name of that game, and Lorne, if you know it, let's just hold it for now, and you can tell me after the show. We'll see if anybody out there can come up with it. Me and a friend, we just could not think of what that game was to even go back and look at it. But anyway, Lauren, could you tell us about the Star Wars games you've been covering then? So you went from these other LucasArts and Sierra games, and you came on board with the Star Wars games. What was it about these in particular you've been covering that just hooked you and left something in your memory so indelible until today?
I don't know if I can really put my finger on it. I think part of it was that when I first started playing X-Wing, I didn't really have much of a recollection of the movies. I remembered all of the big story beats. I knew who all of the major characters were, and I remembered the destruction of the first and second Death Star. But I didn't remember much besides that. And when I entered the game, there were all of these different ships that I didn't remember. I remembered the X-Wing. I didn't remember anything about A-Wings or Y-Wings or B-Wings. I didn't remember that there were other ship types than a TIE fighter on the Imperial side. I didn't recall interceptors or bombers or any of the other craft that eventually got introduced. In the mission briefings, they were referencing all of these different people and place names, and none of it made any sense to me. And I think that's probably what drew me back into watching the movies. And when I when I booted them up when I was older, at this point, I wasn't a little kid anymore. I realized, you know, these are pretty good. And that gave me additional context for what was going on in the mission briefings. And it just had a way of drawing you in. There was also, once I did eventually get a joystick and got a lot better at understanding how the systems in the game worked, there was a challenge to it. And the first game, X-Wing, by today's standards, is in a lot of ways kind of easy. I think part of what drew me in was I realized at a certain point that you could actually take down a Star Destroyer pretty easily if you knew how to do it. And so I started doing that as a challenge anytime there was a Star Destroyer in a mission. I made sure that I killed it. And each time you did, you got another award that you could pin onto your jacket. I think that was probably a big part of it. TIE Fighter was a whole different ball of wax in that, to me, it felt like LucasArts was just showing off with that game. They realized they'd hit a chord with the X-Wing game and the expansion packs. They'd received all of these accolades for it, and they decided, we're going to do the same thing in TIE Fighter, but we're going to frame it from the standpoint that you can play this either as just a random guy who happens to be flying for the Empire, might see it as the legitimate government, might see this as a patriotic duty, and showed that there were worlds within the Empire that maybe welcomed that. But if you wanted to take it a little further, there was this shadowy figure that was outside some of the mission briefings that you could talk to. And this person would give you secondary mission objectives. And that did two things. First of all, it made the missions more difficult because you had to pay attention to more things. It gave you another reward track that you could go down by entering the secret cabal of pilots that were doing special missions for the Emperor. And it also showed the grimy underbelly of the Empire and showing that it really is a corrupted, fascistic organization. And if you're taking this path, you're choosing to participate in that. And I thought, man, that's wild. They really put some depth into this. And it was a lot of fun. I don't think that I actually gave you an article today that is for X-Wing versus TIE Fighter, the next game in the series. It added a lot of new gameplay systems that upped the immersion and made the game even more strategic. But from a story and lore standpoint, I don't think the series ever again achieved the highs of TIE Fighter. So,
well, you know, speaking of that article, it's actually up on That Park Play. So if any of you listeners out there would like to check it out, go look for Lorne's latest article all about Star Wars X-Wing versus TIE Fighter. And enjoy that article. He goes in depth on the dawn of multiplayer and LAN parties when it came to video games with Star Wars. But listening to you, I was thinking back to that time and thinking about the gameplay from inside the cockpit, and sort of a parallel came up in inside what I was pondering. And so I was thinking about companies and how they must have been wanting to also compete with LucasArts. And I thought of Activision with the MechWarrior series. And I was curious, did you ever play MechWarrior 2 specifically? Because I think the others were not as good as MechWarrior 2 inside that BattleTech series. Did you ever play that?
No, I never played the MechWarrior games. I did play a little bit of the Wing Commander games.
Wing Commander, yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't. I didn't gravitate to them quite as much because, honestly, the flight mechanics were a little too slidey for my tastes. That's probably more scientifically accurate. But I like the feeling in the Star Wars games of it being basically like strapping into a World War II fighter. We're just ignoring physics entirely.
Sure, sure. Now, talking about LucasArts and moving on past the Star Wars games, and because they did a lot of different things beyond just Star Wars. I'm thinking that one of my favorite games of all time, honestly, is Day of the Tentacle. And before the show, you were telling me that you had played that one. Have you played the remaster of Day of the Tentacle?
I have. Every one of the remasters that have been put out, I've purchased. I did play the remaster. I didn't play it through to completion. When it came out, I was playing it with my son, and at the time, he was quite a bit younger than he was now, and I was trying to help him along with some of it, but there did come a point at which he got stuck and lost interest, and so I never did play it through to completion again, but I did play it when it first came out, and a lot of my memories of it are sort of vague, but I did love it. I loved just about anything that Tim Schafer was involved in, and sure. If I remember right, I think he was the lead on that one.
And, of course, Tim Schafer is coming back for a new project, which we'll discuss here in just a minute. But, you know, one of the joys that I had recently was that my wife had never encountered any of this LucasArts stuff. And so when I saw that Day of the Tentacle had come out, I think it came out on the Game Pass for Xbox where you could get it for free. And so we downloaded that, and I was just, I just had a really good time watching her take to this game that was 2 decades plus old, and it still held that magic. And she really, really enjoyed it. And it was a lot of fun reliving that through her, through new eyes that had never seen it, never heard the voice acting before. And sure, there were some parts where the difficulty would climb too high, too fast, and it would drop down and everything was obvious after that. And then it would spike again. But overall, it was a really great experience again, and just reminded you of the genius behind these people who were working with very limited resources. I mean, you got to think, on some of these point-and-click adventures, the number of scenes you could do were just very limited, and yet they were able to develop these ingenious puzzles around such a low amount of memory. Now, what's funny about that is, we think about that today and we look back and we go, how did they even fit that onto those floppy disks or onto that one CD or whatever? And back then they were probably thinking, I can't believe I have all this memory. This is amazing that I'm getting to do this. So, but it was a lot of fun.
One of the things that was cool that I saw recently was when they were doing these remasters, Double Fine put out documentaries that were going through the process of making each one of them. And one of the things that they talked about was they were showing a high definition piece of artwork that was basically a poster for Day of the Tentacle. And they said, this JPEG is actually larger than the entire contents of the game, including the sound files. So, yeah, it's wild what they got away with that. I don't remember if that one or Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis were the first talkie that they produced. I think it was Day of the Tentacle.
I think it was, because it was a big deal to go get your sound card so that you could actually play the game the way it was intended.
Yeah, and I remember that back then they had this crazy box for it. It wasn't one of the normal big boxes. It was like a giant vertical triangular box.
Yeah, like a rhombus.
I think it drove retailers nuts because they couldn't fit it on the shelves. But they had this. I mean, it's kind of hard not to overstate what a revelation a game like that was. It was like Tex Avery style animation, and you had professional voice actors. You had Les Nessman from WKRP in Cincinnati doing the voice of Bernard, which was just great. Now we take all of that stuff for granted, but back then that was probably a risky thing to do as an actor, to take on a voice acting job in a game.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. And, you know, just thinking back about those memory constraints, a lot of people today are into the original Mario Brothers. Well, not the original, but the one that came out on the Nintendo Entertainment System, right? So what was that? Super Mario Brothers? Is that what that one was? The original one came out, and it was just Mario and Luigi doing like plumbing. But the one that came out and had the 8 worlds and all that, everybody knows it. It's one of the most iconic games of all time. But a lot of people have gotten into sort of the secrets of that game and the speed running of that game, and they've come across these minus worlds where you can manipulate the game in such a way that it will create levels that were never intended to be created. And today's generation, you know, young kids think, well, how can this be? Surely the developers created it. But no, it's actually the result of memory constraints where they could not put the levels in a straightforward way and get them to fit on that cartridge. And so they had to teach the game to draw these levels in a non-intuitive manner. And so if you just manipulate it, you can convince it to draw levels that aren't supposed to be in there. And so, all of the ways that those early programmers came up with to fit things onto memory levels that just should not be. Sometimes I go back and I look at some of the very early artwork that was going into gaming, and you look at the compression strategies that they have, and you're just like, how could anybody come up with some of this stuff that they used to get the file size down so it would fit? Lauren, I don't know if you ever looked at this. There's Traveler's Tales was a company that developed, I think it was Sonic 3D Blast. And the guy who was the chief programmer or who ran the company for Traveler's Tales, he does a thing on YouTube where he actually breaks down the secrets behind how they managed to get this stuff to run. And it's just, it's just insane. It's like you're listening to these guys and you're thinking, man, you could have landed something on the moon with all this intelligence you had, trying to figure out how you got 12 frames of a pre-rendered CGI to fit on a Sega Genesis cartridge.
This is one of the things that I think is really important to talk about in the software sphere now. It's getting a little easier now that you can spin up virtual machines, but I worry that there is not really a software preservation society of some kind, like we have a film preservation society. And it used to be that we didn't preserve old films either. They just ran in the theater, and when they weren't done, they were done. And a lot of times, due to the chemical processes that were involved in developing the film, over time, the film stock would just melt. And eventually, they realized this is an art form that should be preserved, and they started storing the films in salt mines because it was a cooler temperature and it would slow down that degradation. We don't have something similar for software. And when you have publishers that go out of business and some of these older titles that end up in kind of a weaker limbo, they're in danger of disappearing. And so I'm really happy to see that there has been a number of remaster projects that have taken off. And in a lot of cases, they will allow you to switch between the original art and new remastered art. A lot of times they'll have commentary, videos about the making of the projects. I'd really like to see some kind of a formalized organization begin to tackle that, especially when it comes to trying to figure out how to untangle some of the legal rights for defunct publishers. That's one area that I think GOG, Good Old Games, has done just yeoman's work in resurrecting some of these old titles and trying to make them work on modern systems.
I don't often reveal very much about myself. I'm very protective of my identity, but I will say exclusively in this conversation, I've never explored this under this avatar before, but one of the things that I've done in the past has been a 3D animator. And so I am keenly, let's just say I really love video games, not just from the vantage point of playing them. I'm not the kind of person who even has time to play a lot of video games, especially today. But I love the art of them. I love all the skills that went into making them. And I'm enamored with the strategies they had to come up with in the beginning to get these things to run. And so as you're talking about the need to preserve these video games, I'm looking to my right inside the studio here, and I'm looking at a Sega Dreamcast. I'm looking at some old Atari equipment from the very beginning, right? So the Atari ST, I think, is over here. And, one of the funny things about some of this stuff is that we need to preserve the code, but we also need to find ways to preserve this hardware, because a lot of this stuff is getting to the point now where it was not made to last this long, period. And we're going so far away now that you really can't even repair a lot of this stuff. And I'll give you an example. I'll give you two examples. The first example is there is the Sega Saturn. It's not a popular console. It never was. It's really a failure in a lot of ways. But it's also incredibly unique. The way that machine works is just bizarre. And we don't have time to go into the reasons why. But the Sega Saturn is, I mean, it's very difficult to find consoles that still work, and they are really ticking time bombs. And so we need to find a way to be able to play the stuff on the stuff it was meant to be played upon, if you get my drift. Another example is one of my favorite consoles of all time, a handheld console, was the Atari Lynx. And I love the Atari Lynx because it was so far ahead of its time. I mean, it is just... Now, today it feels like you're holding, you know, a brick in your hands. And it eats batteries like it's going to an all-you-can-eat buffet. But that thing was so far ahead of its time. The only problem was it was too far ahead of its time. And so it was outcompeted by Game Boy and by a lesser extent, the Game Gear. But... you know, those are going out as well. The screens, those backlit screens they had for the Atari Lynxes, they don't last. And so you have to design new screens to replace the old ones. But we need some way, you're right, of having some sort of museum to encapsulate those things on the hardware that they were intended to be played on. So,
yeah, it's, I think what makes gaming unique is that it's the one narrative medium that you actually get to insert yourself into. When it comes to movies, when Roger Ebert was still alive, I used to love to read his reviews, even when I disagreed with him, because he was such an amazing writer. But one of the things that I never could forgive him for was that he had a criticism about gaming, and he said, it's not art. And I would challenge anybody to go up to somebody who has worked on one of these games, who's poured their time and their attention and their skills into producing the artwork, the music, the programming, the logic that goes into making them function. You put a piece of yourself into that, and that's what art is. And I know games have touched people. It changes the way you think. It gives you a moment in time with these characters that live with you after that. And it's worthy of preservation. I know there are some organizations that work to do exactly what we're talking about, preserving old hardware, preserving old software. I'd like to see it get the kind of attention that preserving cinema does, because I think it's worthy of that.
So let's wrap this up now. We sort of teased out that we were going to discuss this at the end, but one of your favorite games of all time is getting a sequel all these years later. And we talked about Tim Schafer earlier. Why don't you tell the audience who's listening in about this upcoming Monkey Island sequel game and sort of what your thoughts are on that? Are you excited? Are you apprehensive? How are you feeling?
All of the above. I've already got my copy pre-ordered. The Secret of Monkey Island holds a very special place in my heart for a number of reasons. One is that is the game that I told you my dad picked out, and I didn't really agree with him, and I was completely wrong. That's one of those games that was formative for me. The characters that are in that series have lived with me now for, I guess, 30 years. And it has a longevity and has touched so many people over the years. It's the only game series that I can think of that over time, it feels like we get about one of these games a decade, and yet it keeps coming back. What makes this particular one unique is that Ron Gilbert, the creator of the series, he was involved with the first two games, and then he left LucasArts. And he had always said that he intended for it to be a trilogy, but LucasArts continued to produce games after he left, and they were not exactly what he had intended. Over the years, he's teased various things about what he would like to do if he would come back and make his Monkey Island 3. He never thought that would even be a possibility. And so I think a lot of people were a little bit nervous about, well, now that you're coming back and doing this, is it going to invalidate the other games that he was not involved with? And it turns out, no. He's borrowing elements from those games. He's going to reference them. He's taking the parts that he liked. He's ignoring the parts that he didn't. There have been narrative issues with Monkey Island all throughout them. That's part of the anachronistic charm of the thing. So I think that'll all work very well. The only thing that I'm nervous about is that, like many other things in pop culture, there's a fear that you can go to the well too many times. And but I trust Ron Gilbert. They put out a video today that was showing some of the conversation with the new pirate leaders on Bay Island. They showed that at Gamescom this weekend. And the dialogue sounds just like the original two games. So I don't think there's probably all that much to worry about.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully it'll go as well as it can, and there'll be lots of people listening to this conversation who'll also be checking it out, and maybe they'll be returning to that nostalgic place in their own mind, or maybe it'll be their first time visiting that world that you've come to love so much. Lauren, let's finish this off by just asking you, what are you playing today? What are the video games that you're enjoying right now?
Well, lately I've been jumping back into Star Wars Squadrons, and that'll be the subject of an article coming up after we get through X-Wing Alliance. That one I'm hoping is going to be a little bit more special. I'm still kind of thinking about how to tease out that article, but it'll be coming here probably in the next couple of weeks. So until then, stay tuned.
Fantastic. And you know, Lauren is the definitive Star Wars author for that Park Place and always putting out fantastic content. All of our readers love the stuff you do, Lauren. As for me on what to play, I'm currently dabbling a little bit in Rocket League still, but I'm also checking out the Cowabunga collection that just came out, the retro collection of all the Ninja Turtle games from years gone by. Well, Lauren, it's been fantastic getting to spend time with you again. I hope we get to do this again in the future. Seems like all of our readers really enjoy these audio articles. We've got away from them a little bit, but hopefully we'll get to go back to them more and more. And everybody just remember that Park Place is your place for all the news that should be fun. Lauren, what do you got to close us out today? Any final thoughts?
No, I just hope that everybody had a great Labor Day weekend. And if you are of the game playing persuasion, I hope you're all having fun and whatever it is that you're playing this week.
There you go. Everybody drop a comment down below. Let us know what you thought about this conversation. Share with us your thoughts, as well as tell us the games that you're playing and the games that you reminisce about. Maybe you'll have something that we also share in common, and we can talk about it in a future article. So thank you all for listening, and we hope you have a wonderful day. Have fun. And remember, come back to that Park Place. We'll keep on telling you all the news that should be fun.